Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
And today, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Lucy Ide. She is the founder of Rimidi. Lucy, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So for the benefit of the listeners, always important, you're one of these double qualified, multiple qualified. You've got a pretty illustrious career and background. Tell us a little bit about how you got to this opportunity and your career through medicine.
Yeah, I've had a bit of a meandering career following a passion around, you know, curiosity and technology, really. So I started my career as a physicist working on communication technologies and went into the startup world on the venture capital side, investing in early stage communication and mobile technologies, and really missed science and wanted to go back to school, decided to go to medical school, but planned to be an academic clinician, you know, run a lab, do research, see patients. And as I got through that process, through my training and out into residency, just became really fascinated with all the systems problems in healthcare and sort of the why we do things the way we do, which isn't always in the best interest of patients or healthcare providers, and how that could be better. And right during that time was the huge push towards electronic health records. So every system where I trained did their first go live from paper to digital. I got to live that pain over and over.
Multiple times. Wow, you've got some scars.
Yeah, and it really drove home to me sort of the power of digitizing all that data, but the missed opportunity around the systems we had built to truly make use of that data for, you know, more efficient workflows, more effective healthcare, and a better experience for patients.
So, before we dive into some of the opportunities, in that experience, it sounds like you probably got some insights into what those missed opportunities were. Having had multiple implementations, was there anything that stood out to you as part of that sort of rollout of digital records?
Yeah, I mean, one very memorable experience was during a training at a health system, and all of the physicians were there for our training. And as the trainer explained to us what the workflow was going to look like and what we were required to do, one of the doctors raised their hand and said, well, wait a minute, now I'm doing my job and part of the nurse's job and part of the clerk's job. And is that really a good use of time? And so this concept of sort of top of license practicing, I think, was really missed in at least a lot of the early implementations of electronic health records, right? We turned physicians into glorified data documenters, which was very frustrating to physicians and took away from the, you know, FaceTime. We've all heard about that, right? All of a sudden, doctors are buried in a laptop or looking at a computer in the corner instead of looking the patient in the eye. So to me, that was one of the biggest misses.
It's funny you mention that. I mean, I talk about this frequently in many of my presentations. You don't find any CEOs entering stock data, but that's essentially what the comparison is for physicians. We ask them to enter all of this information, which always seemed crazy, although I have to take some responsibility having been part of the original sort of drive towards this. So I'll hold up my hand and say we did something not quite right. But moving on, huge value clearly in terms of capturing this. I mean, I think the interesting stat is, although lots of physicians dislike the EHR, I haven't heard too many who'd say, no, I want to go back to the paper record system and, you know, that was better. As we've moved through this, you obviously have charted a career and, you know, the foundation of Rimidi. Tell us a little bit about the genesis of that and how you got to this point.
So the original problem that I was really interested in when I started Rimidi was specifically around diabetes as a use case. And, you know, looking at diabetes as this chronic disease, which is really co-managed by clinicians who are providing, you know, guidance around treatment, but also largely by the patient, right, who lives with it every day. And this long history we had of asking patients to measure glucose. And the lack of data that really had had much impact on outcomes in diabetes over decades. So I was really interested in why, right? Why can't we do better in managing diabetes outcomes when we spend, you know, I think at that time about $1 billion a year of NIH funding on diabetes research. So the problem wasn't that we didn't understand it. And then we have all this data in patients' hands at home that is really not leveraged in decision-making. And so trying to sort of square all of that of, you know, why can't we use data and intelligent systems to help both providers and patients sort of operationalize all of these really great guidelines and insights we have into this disease. So it was like, remote monitoring, before remote monitoring was a thing, was sort of the concept of we've got to get that patient data to the clinician in near real time. We've got to enable some clinical decision support around it to help them make more personalized and targeted decisions around that patient's care.
So what was the journey to the setup of the organization? How did you get there? Because not every physician sets up a company to solve a problem.
Yeah, my first instinct was actually to go back to venture capital. And I thought, okay, I'll take my healthcare experience. I'll go invest in technologies that will make our healthcare system better in some way, better outcomes or more cost effective or a better experience. And as I started looking at those opportunities, I realized that fundamentally one of the problems with some of the early health records was true with a lot of the other innovation happening in health IT, which is you didn't have enough people who understood the end user experience designing these systems, and that we needed the voice of clinicians, you know, doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and patients going into the design of systems meant to help those people. And, you know, so I sort of jumped off into the deep end and said, okay, if that's what the market needs, and I had developed this curiosity around diabetes, you know, why not?
So as you think about that sort of user experience and the failure to sort of really understand, tell us a little bit about Rimidi and what it is that you're doing to help solve that problem.
So one thing that became really obvious is we, you know, built early versions of our product and took it out to clinicians was this issue around clinical workflow. And you know, the example I often give to people is, you know, even doctors would like to go home at the end of the day, right, and have dinner with their family on a fairly usual basis or be able to leave the office. And, you know, a lot of folks were, and still do, right, document in the evening to close out their charts. And in many ways, the EHRs have extended the length of their day. So it became very obvious that introducing technology that even if it improved patient outcomes, but, you know, necessitated longer hours and more time was just a no-go, right, that the market would not accept that. So that's how I became really focused on this issue of interoperability and specifically FHIR while FHIR was still sort of an academic project, became very interested in that. And we were one of the early companies, is it became apparent that that was going to be sort of the winning common data standard, because to me it solved for this issue of how do we bring innovation into the workflow while it has to fit within that EMR, that the doctor really can't care about anything that isn't in their existing workflow.
So the process of bringing in data, essentially what you're starting to do is to integrate both the patient data, as you described, the diabetics, so blood sugars, and we know what to do, we just weren't actioning it, pulling that in, integrating with healthcare data and pulling that together. It sounds like another dashboard to me.
Right. So I think the third component of that is clinical decision support. And, you know, clinical decision support isn't a new concept. It's been around, but I think really reimagining that and what have we learned from all the reasons it hasn't worked in the past and alarm fatigue and all the problems it's had. And I think there was actually a really good article about that I read this week, that the key there is really personalization, right? You have to make it contextually appropriate. You have to make it really personal to that patient's data, and as well as have clinical buy-in. So we have, in addition to being an early adopter of FHIR, been an early adopter of CDS Hooks. And I think there's a lot of power in that technology and that concept of how we bring these actionable insights and prompts into the workflow in a way that really meets the clinician's needs. And so part of it is also having clinical buy-in, right? Wherever we deploy this, it's almost designed by the clinicians at that that client's site to make sure it's meeting their needs, not what some outside company thinks their needs are.
Yeah, so that this is all about going back to the customer and getting their perspective, in this case, the physicians, pulling in information, that personalization to the individual. But one of the key elements to this feels like it's the collection of that data. And certainly based on my experiences, that's not an easy task. Has FHIR helped solve this, do you think? Or is the, where do you see this whole connection and interoperability going?
You know, so I think FHIR is the best we have right now, and it certainly has allowed us to actually, you know, prove in the market the original concept behind FHIR. If you can build an application once and deploy it across multiple systems. So we have a platform that's deployed across Cerner and Epic and Athena and NextGen, and sure, there are nuances between those, but we can essentially run the same software for clinicians no matter what EMR platform they're on. So to me, that's a big win, right? And we can bring in this patient-generated health data from connected devices, from wearables. We're now doing some patient-reported outcomes work. So, you know, survey data from patients back into the EMR workflow. So I think we're getting there, right? We're starting to talk about the concept of, you know, FHIR-enabled medical devices. Most of those have proprietary and unique APIs right now, but down the road, we envision those will speak FHIR as well, and you'll have devices that can speak FHIR directly to the EHR. So, you know, it's healthcare. It takes a while, but I think we're making progress.
So clearly, you know, huge progress. For those of you just joining, I'm Dr. Nick, the incrementalist, and today I'm talking to Dr. Lucy Ide. She is the founder of Remedy. We were talking about interoperability. You know, the best available option is always available. In this case, FHIR is that for interoperability, but obviously pulling in other data sources. As you look at that in terms of remote monitoring, obviously in the context of all of the things going on now, that must be a big part of the potential opportunity. I think we see the scope to start more remote monitoring. I mean, I know I've spent more time at home than I ever did before. I'm sure that's true for many people, good and bad. But the good is we can do more in the home. And I think you're starting to see some of that.
Yeah, I think remote monitoring and telemedicine are really having their moment. So, you know, hopefully we don't waste some of the opportunity created by this crisis to really accelerate the adoption of technology. And, you know, it feels a bit like, you know, what happened in finance a decade ago. I mean, none of us go to the bank to do banking transactions anymore, right? You do it on your phone. And maybe what's happened with grocery delivery over the past couple of years, that, you know, I really think this is the moment in healthcare where, you know, convenience and using modern technologies to support data sharing and multiple modalities of interacting between a patient and a provider, not just in clinic face-to-face, which absolutely has its role. Right? But we can do a lot of the other work through asynchronous data sharing, through synchronous video calls, and it's sort of the spectrum of care that's going to take hold.
So as you think about this from a pandemic perspective, there's clearly both the potential to do that remote monitoring. Obviously, if you do that, you can prevent people from coming into work or spreading the disease. Have you started to see that with some of the clients that you're working with, where you pull in this data that's starting to provide signals? Have you seen, you know, the opportunity to start to do better as we try and monitor these pandemics and epidemics?
So we started back in March, actually, with some of our clients enabling automated screening prior to appointments to try to minimize exposure of patients who were knowingly or unknowingly, you know, sick with COVID coming into a clinic and exposing other patients seeking regular care or exposing staff. So we've been at this, I guess, for 6 months about now, and have sort of taken that initial experience of automating what were a lot of really manual workflows people had to stand up at the early stages of the pandemic, of, you know, people with clipboards at doors or telephone triage nurses who just didn't have enough time to answer all the incoming calls, much less make outgoing calls to try to screen people who were scheduled to come in to the clinic or the health system. So we've actually been doing that via FHIR-enabled questionnaires and then triaging those patients to appropriate care. And because we have this integration with the EHR, we know all the background health data about those patients. So somebody who, you know, is older, has multiple chronic conditions, and is experiencing and reporting potential COVID symptoms, we've all seen that some of those patients have had, you know, have worse outcomes. And so helping prioritize as well, you know, who could be sick at home and might need medical attention, and getting that right attention to them proactively instead of waiting for them to get worse and show up at the emergency room. So it's been a really interesting experience. I think it's been great to be able to support our clients that way. And now we're working on some of what you were getting at of, you know, connecting in wearable data, and can we get signals off of wearable devices that can actually replace, if you will, these sort of symptom reporting and exposure tracking applications with continuous passive monitoring that can detect early signs of COVID and get those people tested to really try to contain and limit the spread of disease.
Yeah, so I mean, to be clear, I think early days, but clearly an opportunity that, you know, if there are signals, the first thing you got to do is gather that data and incorporate it into something that you can look at and study, which I think is where you started to do, you know, some of the key work with your clients, that integration. As you look at the data that's we're seeing, obviously, we've seen this huge disparity in terms of impact of COVID-19. Tell us a little bit about your experiences there and what you've seen in the data around the disparities of COVID's impact.
Yeah, I mean, I think the disparities around, you know, populations who were affected and then their outcomes, right? So as I've referenced, there's a lot of data now around people who have chronic conditions, but also around, you know, minority and medically underserved communities who not only have a harder time accessing care, may have health literacy barriers, and tend to over-index on these chronic conditions that predispose them to worse outcomes. So it's really sort of a perfect storm in some of those communities. And we've done some great iterative work with clients around really iterating on the kinds of questions, English, Spanish, addressing, you know, that some communities may not recognize symptoms the way that other communities do. And so how do we ask questions to really identify those individuals who are at risk or who potentially have COVID, and tailoring that to the community?
So enormous problem, you know, big disparities across, you know, these populations. I think you've got some exciting news around that in terms of the focus on this and how we can start to address it.
Yeah. And again, as I said earlier, you know, I think it's, there is a national spotlight on this issue of health disparities, you know, minority and medically underserved communities that a lot of us in the industry, you know, have talked about and worried about. And for years, it's not new. It's just that the attention it's getting is new. And so how can we leverage this moment of national attention on health disparities to make some real and lasting progress on the topic? So an organization I'm part of, the Connected Health Initiative, together with the Consumer Technology Alliance, are forming a working group called HEAL, which is Health Equity and Access Leadership, and bringing together both major technology companies in the industry, as well as academic medical centers and other healthcare leadership, and including multiple government agencies in the dialogue as well, to really come out in January with policy recommendations on how to make meaningful and measurable progress on the health disparities issue. And some of what I mean by that is, you know, what's the role of technology in overcoming health disparities, right? Can remote monitoring and telemedicine really change the access problem? You know, it makes sense. Sure, we could all say yes. If you could provide, you know, remote access to care, that would overcome the barrier for people who don't have transportation, don't have adequate health care in their community. But then what are the barriers to that? Are there barriers around reimbursement? Are there barriers around affordability? And so we're really going to dive into those issues and get input across the industry to make recommendations.
Fantastic. I mean, I think that's, you know, tremendously exciting, incredibly important, and, you know, I think the recurring incremental step that I keep hearing through this pandemic crisis is don't let any crisis go to waste. And I know somebody famous said that. I just can't recall who it is. As we think about the future. Tell us what you're excited about and what's coming up in the coming months beyond the sort of CTA.
You know, I mean, I think I'm excited to see how we leverage what has been sort of a sprint in terms of adopting new technology in clinical workflow, because people were forced to do it, right? Because of the pandemic, they were forced to move to these more virtual models of care, and sort of how we transition into the marathon mode, right? If this is for the long haul, and what needs to happen to make this scalable and sustainable across the industry, and really make it work for doctors. You know, I believe this can help address some of the clinical burnout if we can really use technologies to provide a better experience for patients, but also a better experience for the clinicians who are caring for them. So I'm really focused on that of, you know, how can we, you know, leverage this opportunity to virtualize care to, you know, solve some very longstanding issues in the industry.
Fantastic. I think there's so much potential. We've sort of exposed all of these inadequacies in the system. And, you know, this is the time to really sort of impact and create change. These interoperability to bring in the data, the presentation of that so that, you know, clinicians in general can actually start to deliver better care as opposed to focusing on the technology, I think is incredibly important and highly relevant. And as you said, relative to the burnout. Any closing thoughts in the last minute?
You know, I love the title of your podcast because it's, you know, healthcare can be a frustrating industry to work in when you see all the potential to improve and all the current problems. And it really is these incremental changes that build on each other and just take a lot of hard work. So, you know, I'm excited about it because I see that incremental change happening, and there's so much forward momentum around healthcare technology, and we just all have to stick with it and be patient and be persistent.
Fantastic. So what I would close by saying is radical incrementalism that can speed up that change. It doesn't have to be slow just because it's small steps. So just remains for me to thank you for joining me on the show. It's been a true delight. I'm excited about the journey, excited about the output from the working group Heal, and look forward to hearing more. Lucy, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, The Incrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.